Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome. Welcome to the Trampoline Hall podcast. I'm your host, Misha Globerman. Trampoline Hall is a lecture series that takes place in a bar, usually in Toronto, but sometimes in other cities. People give lectures on all kinds of subjects, with the one restriction being that they cannot lecture on subjects on which they are professionally expert. After each lecture, we take questions from the audience. Trampoline Hall, just so you know, if you're listening to this, you probably know this, but Trampoline Hall is originated as a live show in a bar in Toronto. We've been doing it every month in Toronto for a very, very long time. The podcast has been around now actually for a year, which might seem like a long time, but it's not actually that long. And while Trampoline Hall has been every month just like clockwork, the podcast has been tremendously irregular, just different schedules all the time. We had one last month. We're going to have one next month. And I'll tell you now, the schedule is probably going to change again, which is that what we're going to do is we're going to be moving to sort of mini seasons. So what we're going to do is we're going to release six in a row, like one every week for 6 weeks. Then we'll take a bunch of time off, and our producer Josh Block will like run the podcast making machine for a while, and then we'll come back and we'll do another block of six episodes in a little season. We'll keep you posted about the exact dates on that, but that is what the future of Trampoline Hall holds. Also, I'll tell you this: if you like the show and you're in Toronto, you should come see the live show. It's like the podcast, except it's alive. If you want to know about that, you can check out our website, join our email list. That's great. You will love it. That's a lot for you to know, so I think now is the time to go to this episode's lecture. Let me warn you first, this episode, like every episode, may contain mature language. The topic of the lecture for this episode is etiquette, and the lecturer is Amy Langstaff.
Hello, my name is Amy. I have a friend named Peter who was in law school in the mid-70s, and he had a friend in law school who was a car enthusiast, and he'd always planned since he was a kid to buy himself a stylish car when he finished all his education. So sure enough, they were finishing up law school, and this guy, you know, broke the piggy bank that he'd been filling literally like since prepubescence, and bought himself quite a stylish car. And one of the features of the stylish car was a very pleasing tan leather interior, I'm told. So law school is wrapping up, and they have a big end of year party. My friend Peter and his friend are there, and the friend is going to give Peter a lift home in the new car. So they set out from the party, and they come upon a professor of theirs who's leaving the party on foot. And Peter and his friend both really like and admire this professor. Partly they think he's brilliant, so they respect him intellectually, but they also find him very debonair, and they admire his gentlemanly smoothness. So he's a favorite of theirs. And they pull up beside him, and they ask him if he'd like a ride. And he's very gracious. It's clear that he's quite drunk, but he's very gracious, and he says he would like a ride. So Peter hops into the back seat, and the professor gets into the passenger seat, and off they go. And after a few minutes, Peter, in the back seat, hears the sound of vomiting. And he knows that the professor is vomiting all over the tan leather interior of the brand new car. But then as he sort of peers around the edge of the passenger seat to assess the damage, he realizes that the professor is not, in fact, vomiting all over the tan leather interior of the brand new car. The professor is vomiting very tidily into his own sleeve, thus... Yes, he is. And so as the vomiting concludes, they're pretty much at the professor's home by that point. And so he gets out of the car and, holding his sleeve erect so as not to spill any vomit into the car, he exits the vehicle. And then with sort of a whipping motion, evacuates the vomit as best he can from the sleeve onto the sidewalk. And he turns, obviously, to the dumbfounded students. You know, they don't know what to say. And he turns to the two students and he says, "Once a gentleman, always a gentleman." So this anecdote is pretty close to my heart for a number of reasons, but the biggest one is that I am a chronic sleeve vomiter. I've never actually literally vomited into my sleeve, but I do so metaphorically all the time. And by that I mean that when embarrassing situations arise, I almost invariably would rather just take the lumps myself, like physical pain or monetary expenditure or clothing destruction or whatever. I would rather just take the lumps myself than allow awkwardness to linger in the air. And I think I'm probably not the only sleeve vomiter in the room. Like, if you have ever been faced with an offensive joke and just sort of smiled weakly because you couldn't face the social disruption that would result if you delivered the scolding that righteousness demanded of you, that is sleeve vomiting behavior. If you've ever pretended that you weren't sick because you didn't want to deal with the extra attention and the frou-frou of, you know, revealing to others that you were in physical discomfort, also sleeve vomiting behavior. If you've ever actually vomited into your sleeve, obviously, you know, you do the math. You're a sleeve vomiter also. So I was sort of interested in awkwardness and how that works and what's so bad about it that we would actually, like, endure physical pain or, like, vomit into our sleeves or whatever in order to sort of put it off. So I did a little reading on behalf of Trampoline Hall, and I found that there seem to be three major theories of embarrassment among, like, social psychologists and sociologists and people like that. And they seem to be, one, there's the self-esteem theory of embarrassment, which suggests that we feel embarrassed when our actual behavior in the world fails to measure up to our ideal versions of ourselves, visions of ourselves. So, you know, you don't think of yourself as a yutz, and then you act like a yutz, and you get embarrassed. So that makes sense. The second theory of embarrassment is the social esteem theory of embarrassment, which suggests that, you know, you worry if you commit a social blunder that you'll fall in other people's estimation of you and you'll lose social status. The third theory, which I would like to talk about a little bit tonight, is called the awkward interaction theory of embarrassment. And as far as I can tell, this was first advanced by the sociologist Irving Goffman. And in 1956, Irving Goffman wrote in the American Journal of Sociology, "The elements of a social encounter consist of effectively projected claims to an acceptable self and the confirmation of like claims on the parts of others." So when we interact socially, we all sort of project our acceptable selves into the scene, and then we all agree that that's who we are, and we all sort of prop up and reinforce each other's claims about our acceptable selves and how acceptable we all are, which is so acceptable. And then when one person gets embarrassed, that person can't suffer on their own because all of our acceptable selves are sort of interdependent, and so everyone else's identity starts to sort of cave in a little bit, and the whole system is kind of destabilized. So Goffman writes that after an embarrassing moment, the inhabitable reality shrinks until everyone feels small or out of place. True enough. So to me, the awkward interaction theory is the only theory that, you know, of the three, that really explains all the rich nuances of social awkwardness. You know, my fellow sleeve vomiters in the crowd, I'm sure, will attest that there are, like, a bazillion ways to feel embarrassed and awkward. You know, you can be embarrassed for yourself. You can be embarrassed for somebody else. You can be embarrassed at the idea that somebody else might be feeling embarrassed for you. There are just so many layers of, like, fear and vulnerability and empathy and just insecurity. And I think that the awkward interaction theory is the only one that really encompasses that whole rich tapestry of anxiety that is social life. I think the other two theories would probably posit that when other people get embarrassed and we feel it, you know, that's empathy. We know that it's hard to suffer from embarrassment, and that we feel for other people when they, you know, get embarrassed. But, like, speaking for myself only, obviously, you guys might be more magnanimous, but speaking for myself only, when I see somebody else humiliated, it registers in parts of my body that really only care about me. Like, I don't think there's any altruism in that feeling that I get when I see other people embarrassed. Like, it's really a survival, like, seizure. So I think it's those feelings are actually too visceral to be empathy, basically. Anyway, so we're all sort of involved in this conspiracy of face-saving, which is not always to the good, because we let people get away with bad behavior because, you know, we can't face the awkwardness of confronting them about bad behavior. And as far as reinforcing other people's identities, you know, we make assumptions about people and we stereotype and we make false claims about ourselves and all that. So there are lots of flaws, but there are three things about the awkward interaction theory that make me feel a little bit better about being a human being, and I'm going to tell you what those are. The first is, I find it really lovely, the idea that we're all sort of stewards of each other's identities, and that when we interact socially, we all kind of hold each other together and take care of each other and make each other comfortable in a way, even if we don't think we're doing it, and even if, you know, we're among strangers or whatever, we're actually kind of looking out for each other. And that's related to my second point, which is that in the awkward interaction theory, there's no way of disentangling our self-interest from other people's interest, because since we suffer so much from other people's embarrassment, and our comfort is so organically connected to other people's comfort, we have this visceral interest in sort of protecting other people from embarrassment. It strikes me that this is probably like a not perfectly calibrated aspect of human beings, because I know that I can sometimes meet someone and I know that they're like desperately sad or in pain or whatever, and I can sometimes manage to feel pretty much nothing about that. And, you know, not all the time, but sometimes. And then I meet somebody who is pretty much fine in life and they have like mustard on their face, and I just feel it in my bones. Like, I'm collapsing from this weird empathic relationship with them. So that doesn't make a lot of sense, but I do think, though, that, you know, there's at least one area of life in which we have some kind of weird, almost physiological compulsion to take care of other people as we would take care of ourselves. And so, you know, that's, I'll take that where I can get it. The final thing is that I like the idea that after a moment of embarrassment, because everyone's identity has been a little bit destabilized, a little bit shaken, everything's kind of up for grabs. Like, how will it all be reconstructed again? And, you know, as you know, like, almost all the time, you know, somebody makes a crack and we all, like, get back on track and we just move forward as we were before. But there's always a chance, like, there's a crack in everything in a moment of embarrassment, and there's always a chance that, you know, no one will ever be the same again. So that's kind of, that's kind of exhilarating. And actually, if you read, you know, if you read the letters in teen magazines, you know, that when the girls write in their embarrassing moments, like, 99% of them end with the line, "and he never spoke to me again," which suggests, you know, they couldn't reconstruct their identities vis-a-vis one another. So just before I close, I'd just like to come back to my new favorite professor. So he's just vomited, just, you know, in the car of his student, and his, you know, poor judgment and his bad behavior and his bodily vulnerability, all these things have been put on pretty glaring display for these two students. And for his dismount, he says, "Once a gentleman, always a gentleman." And I don't want to, you know, eviscerate the joke because it's so gentle and great, but I do think that what he's doing is he's sort of reconstructing his acceptable self for them. And instead of trying to grasp back at the debonair mentor status he enjoyed pre-vomit, he sort of pokes fun at that status, and he offers them a new acceptable self that's a little bit, you know, richer and more human than the old acceptable self. And I think it's quite lovely. So I think the reason that anecdote really gets to me is that, you know, those of us who are sleep vomiters know that the war against awkwardness is like an unending war. Like, it will never end and it will never be won. But some battles are more successful than others. And I think that on that occasion, those three people together kind of achieved a a victory over shame that was quite dignified and quite decisive and quite sweet. And I think it was so decisive and so sweet that, you know, here we all are. I hope that you are, as I am, taking comfort and courage from the war story 30 years later. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Trampoline Hall Podcast. I'm Misha Goldman. Up next, the Q&A.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Are there any questions? I know it's so complete, it seems hard to imagine. But yes, you ma'am.
I just have a question for, do you have any advice? I know people who are compulsive sleep vomiters who see someone vomit into their sleep and promptly puke themselves. Do you have any advice for those people?
Oh, for actual nausea? I'm prone to that as well, so I'm interested in this.
That and the metaphorical way, but the people who see someone else and they empathize so much that they...
What, like who put mustard on their own face in response to the other person?
It's troubling. I don't think anyone has the answers right now. I we're all advancing and growing and learning, but I don't know right now.
What's an example of figurative? I can't even...
Not so much mustard on the face, but I know some people, someone will say something embarrassing and then, you know, someone sitting at the table realize, well, that was an embarrassing thing to say, and so they'll regale them with a similar tale to sort of cover up the embarrassment of the other person, hence making themselves more embarrassed than they otherwise would have been.
Oh, but do you think everyone's increasingly suffering or everyone's increasingly enjoying the stories of embarrassment? Because actually, when I was reading about embarrassment, they've done, you know, studies about how people try to recover from embarrassment and how people try to help people who have been embarrassed. And actually, some of the helping techniques are things like sharing, you know, stories when you have been similarly embarrassed. So that might be actually a quite constructive behavior. I don't know if we should put the kibosh on that at all.
All right, so we say yes, carry on, co-vomiters of sleeves. Yes, you ma'am.
Have you done any experiments into taking advantage of that rift? Like redefining yourself in a pre-planned manner?
What do you have in mind? What are you...
I'm wondering like if it's possible or if you have any experience of like just, you know, jumping on top of the social ladder in a moment like that.
Oh, you mean like when things collapse? When things collapse, like Amy could somehow like emerge as queen?
Such a good. I'm gonna strategize with you after about that because I really just learned about this opportunity in the last week. So, and I'm not sure if I have the gumption for it, but if I can get it together, I would. We should talk.
You get into the elevator with your boss. The doors close. He farts. Suddenly, you're the boss when the doors open. No one knows how. Just everything's up for grabs.
That's an ill-fitting suit, Amy. You're fired.
Anything else that people... yes, you, sir.
Has your research turned up any possible treatments or therapies? Because for myself, I've got the sleeve problem so bad, I have to actually turn away from the TV if something embarrassing is happening to a fictional character.
No, I hear you loud and clear.
I'm running out of jackets, is what I'm saying.
Oh my god, I'm so there with you. In fact, I had a part that I took out of the speech because it's too long, but I had a part about how I... physically can't watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, like literally physically, because it's just too troubling to me. So I don't have the answers, but I definitely feel your pain, like really in here.
Yes, you may.
What about bullies, people that seek out embarrassment? Are they like agents of social change?
Thank you for your taunt.
Obviously they are.
Yes, okay, great, there you go. That's the way to treat them when they ask like that. Anything else? Anything else that of you, sir? Yes.
Okay, so my question is, would you rather be like you or like me, which is that what I do is...
It'd be such a good question if you ended it right there.
Okay, well, so the difference between you and me is that I, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, there's, you know, plenty of people like this, but, you know, I anticipate the possibilities of embarrassment so far in advance and then, you know, go out of my way to avoid them completely, you know, you know what I mean? Like, you just stay away from everything that could possibly...
But you, don't you see that you'll never be queen if you persist in that behavior? Like, you're going to miss out on exactly the kind of opportunity that we're talking about here tonight. No, I actually do that as well. But I'm going to try, you know, in all honesty, like, I'm going to try and stop and just calm the hell down about the sleep vomiting and the embarrassment, if at all possible. Like, ideally, I would become queen, but failing that, I think I would like to just, you know, encounter the embarrassment and the awkwardness head on and just take some deep breaths and come out stronger on the other side. Once a gentleman, always a gentleman.
So wait, are you specific? So in response to the question from the fellow over there, you're specifically saying that a policy of non-confrontational cowardice you don't think is a better path?
No. Okay. No, I don't, actually.
All right. Sorry. Yes, you, sir.
You keep talking about these experiments that you read about. I'm curious the nature of the actual experiments.
That's a great question. So the question is, what are the actual, like, scientific experiments where they embarrass people?
Well, they differ, but depending on the discipline, they differ. Like, social psychologists are always doing weird stuff where they just, like, send their grad students out into the world to do kooky things. Maybe I just was doing bad research, but I didn't find all that much work in embarrassment. The ones that I found were, like, social psychologists would send students out into the world to do awkward things, and the students would actually frequently not be able to do the awkward things because really the physiological compulsions are so intense. Like, I work with a social psychologist who tried to get his grad students to go and stand the wrong way in an elevator, and they couldn't. Like, they came back and they were like, we can't do the experiment, it's impossible. And he was like, you guys are such wusses. Like, kids today just suck, you know, kids suck. And he went out and tried to do it. He physically could not do it himself either. So that's one thing. The thing I was talking about with the strategies for helping people and stuff, that was just some academics got a huge, like, many hundreds of undergraduates to, like, submit, you know, just written stories of embarrassment and how they responded and how other people responded. So methodology varies. It's all equally shaky, but methodology varies according to discipline, I guess.
So there you go. Was it like a job you were hoping to get? Were you like, I would like to be a
worst job. Worst job.
I think it depends who you are. I think that there are those who would happily go around vomiting in other people's sleeves.
But
I think there are such people in the world.
You know, they'd screw up all the variables. If you're not experiencing enough anxiety, you know, you...
That's true. Are there any other questions? Oh, from the stage. I'm sorry. Yes, you may.
Ounce of prevention is worth...
Pounds cures, ounce of preventions.
Then could we not work towards just unembarrassing things? Like, is there not a fine line between mustard and makeup?
Sorry, what's your... I don't understand your question.
What if we could, like, prevent a situation being embarrassing instead of trying to remedy one?
Oh, like making everything okay so that nothing's embarrassing? Be like, it's cool, like, make mustard on your face cool? Is that the idea?
Maybe we stretch ourselves.
Okay.
I think that's a great question. And I think actually we already expend a lot of effort in that direction, like trying to make things less embarrassing or trying to cover up when things are... I don't know whether we can actually relax the rules. I think that's kind of an intergenerational thing. I don't know if we can all pull it off, you know, us right now. But actually, this Goffman paper is really beautiful. In 1956, Irving Goffman, American Journal of Sociology, check it out. But he says at the end that people are actually kind of sacrificial lambs in social systems that embarrass us. So when you experience embarrassment, you're actually coming up against like social rules that are in conflict, or like society is demanding more than one, asking you to play more than one role at the same time, and you as an individual are kind of the sacrificial lamb that, like, you know, acts as a buffer between these huge social systems. And the closing line in the essay is, social structure gains elasticity, the individual merely loses composure.
Wow.
It's lovely. No, it's nice.
Wow. So there you go.
Did you have a question? Or did that, was
your question if she had a pithy quote? I'll just repeat it. So he has a 2-year-old kid and he gets embarrassed for the kid.
Well, I get embarrassed for him when he grabs something and goes, I'm waiting for the fireworks. And it's like, we can buffer that for him because we can go, really? Wow. A 10-year-old kid goes, what the hell are you talking?
Wait, so your 2-year-old grabs somebody and he says, I'm waiting for the fireworks. And does he mean that figuratively or does he? What? Oh, at the fireworks. Oh, okay, so it's not inappropriate. So how to make this less embarrassing for yourself, basically?
Yeah, it's just brutal to watch him get socially.
Oh, because like the 10-year-olds diss him? Okay, all right, gotcha. Okay.
Well, no, the 10-year-old...
So he has a 2-year-old kid, and the 2-year-old kid is overly enthusiastic about fireworks and presumably other things in the company of 10-year-olds whose blasé, world-weary ways make the enthusiasm of the 2-year-old seem dorky, even though to us, we find it charming. And it is a generational thing. It's cool if you're 2 or if you're 30, but if you're 10, it's really not on. And so you want to know if there's something you can do about that?
How do I situate myself to that so I don't have bad feelings?
How can you not have bad feelings? I'm sorry. Now that we've got there, I'll give it to you to answer.
Well, I mean, point one is, like, your child is an angel and the 10-year-olds are jerks. Like, that's point one. So, you know, take comfort there. And, you know, and you can take pride in the fact that you've created a human being in cooperation with some partner, possibly. I don't know. Maybe adopted, that's great. Like, anyway, but you're the guardian of this small human being, and that's wonderful. And 10-year-olds are 10. Like, I think you should shake it off. I think you should...
It's tough love we offer here at Trampoline Hall. Just buck up. Yes, you ma'am.
Talking about how we all feel really terrible when anybody else does anything embarrassing. But that feeling is a very, very anxious feeling, and it's a very large feeling. But isn't part of that like the euphoria of not having been the person to have done that at that moment?
No.
It's funny, you would think that there would be something delicious about it, but for me it's just pure anxiety, because for some reason, you know, if one of you, you know, God love you, if you want one of you tripped right now, I would feel like it was my responsibility to like sort things out from up here. And I would actually experience no pleasure at all, because for some reason I think that of all the whatever 100 people in here, whoever, whatever it is, it's my job to make sure that you don't trip. And I don't know if that's my mom or whose fault that is, but it's not pleasurable.
Is it more painful for you to watch someone else be in an embarrassing situation or for yourself to be in one?
It's different. I would say it's actually maybe more painful, because I feel more powerless when the other person, like if I'm in an embarrassing situation, I can, you know, make a little crack or, you know, flee or whatever. I'm sort of I'm more in control. Whereas the other or the worst is when somebody, you know, should be embarrassed and they're not, and you've got to shoulder all their shame that they should be feeling, all your shame, all the solutions that the room should be generating. It's really daunting.
All right, sure, yes. He's there.
Was there any mention about reliving embarrassing situations to figure out what you should have done right to plan for the future for next time?
About reliving embarrassing situations, like
in your own mind,
for the sake of improvement or for the sake of self-torture or both?
For either.
All right.
I think it's actually a trick question, because when something's really embarrassing, it's not that you couldn't quite figure out the nuances of what the right move was. It's that the right move was so abundantly clear and you couldn't do it. It's not like you have to sort of fiddle with the situation afterwards. It's like, well, maybe if I just carried the one, it could have... There's no nuance. Like, you're just a seething idiot. And then...
Not spilling the wine on her shirt.
Exactly. For example.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes, all the way near the back of the room with your hand up.
So just to follow up on this Curb Your Enthusiasm thing, is there like an entire branch of comedy that's just lost on you?
Yeah.
It's not lost. Like, I get it when I see it. Wow, do I get it when I see it. It's not lost on me. It's just too physically painful for me to, you know, pay $3 to, you know, rent it and bring it home and put myself through that. Like, I can just do it on the subway one day, you know, God forbid.
Right. Yes, you, ma'am.
How do you feel about kissing? On...
Please save it for after the lecture.
Funny you should ask.
I mean, kissing on sitcoms.
Oh, kissing on film and screen, film and television.
Yes, yes.
Does that embarrass you?
No, I feel great about that. Like, I'm not squeamish. It's about people acting. Well, if it's a stupid kiss. But yeah, no, kissing,
okay,
great. Even more, you know, beyond. Kissing and beyond, fine, but just don't be embarrassing.
Right, just so long as nothing gets spilled or broken during the kiss.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that's all we could know. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Amy Langston.
Trampoline Hall was created in Toronto in the 21st century by Sheila Hetty and is hosted by me. This episode's lecture was chosen by Margot Williamson. This podcast is produced by Josh Block. Our theme music was composed by Matt Smith. Trampoline Hall is a podcast, which means you can subscribe to it on all the ways you normally get to podcasts. You can also find us on Twitter and on Facebook. If you like the podcast, you can leave us a review on iTunes. That really helps us out a lot. Also, if you like the podcast and you're in Toronto, you can come see the live show. Go to our website. You can find out when the shows are and sign up for our email list to get announcements. I'm Misha Globerman. Thanks so much for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.